Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm Jackson. I put the top in topsy-turvy.
Thank you for joining us. Before we go any further, I do want to throw out a few trigger warnings. We're going to be discussing Hunchback of Notre Dame this episode, which includes Frollo, which includes some unsavory sexual assault stuff. If you're not up for that, come back to this episode later.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're still here, thank you for joining us. This is episode 25 of our Disney bracket. As I said, we'll be discussing Hunchback of Notre Dame as well as Moana.
So this is now the third time I've watched these movies this year. For Moana, it's like the fifth time. I'm starting to go further and further out as far as like things to dig into. I apologize if the stuff I talked about gets increasingly weird.
I think that's kind of the nature of this sort of stuff. We've both watched each of these movies three times within the past 6 months.
Right. But, like, I spent a good chunk of my watch through for Hunchback researching the late medieval, early Renaissance French education system.
I think a good place to start is to talk about how these films wound up in the quarterfinals of a bracket.
So, Moana went up against what? Pocahontas first?
Yeah. In round one of our bracket, specifically episode two. That episode was pretty cut and dry. There's a lot of similarities between Pocahontas and Moana, and Moana, in general, does a better job of not being grossly culturally appropriative and being racist.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that it 100% is free of those criticisms, but it's significantly better.
I think not having the John Smith aspect alone helps it a lot.
Mm-hmm. And then in round two, Moana went up against Bolt.
Which I do love. Bolt is great. But it has some fumbles here and there. It's definitely still part of that experimental period. And the animation doesn't quite hold a candle to the opening scene of Moana.
It's a kind of an odd story, narratively speaking, for Disney. It's interesting that they decided to go that route, but I'm not sure that it holds up in comparison to the tried and true Disney fairy tale. In comparison, we have Hunchback of Notre Dame, which in episode 3 went up against Cinderella.
One of those Disney iconic classics, but has the problem of Disney fare of the time where there's a lot of dead time that's mostly just wacky animation stuff, which isn't bad, but there's less story.
It's not so much that it's bad, it's more so that what we expect as a culture from our films now has progressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then in episode 18, Hunchback went up against completely opposite end of the spectrum, Wreck-It Ralph.
Which is a far more recent film, and you know, has that slick, modern 3D CGI that actually looks good now.
However, Wreck-It Ralph didn't quite have the painstaking artistry that Hunchback has. We don't have an equivalent in Wreck-It Ralph of all those gorgeous scenes of Paris and of Notre Dame Cathedral.
And while Wreck-It Ralph is grappling with a lot of good themes, some of them get kind of messy as they all slam together, whereas Hunchback has a more coherent thematic throughline.
That's how they got here. Let's talk about how they're going to move forward.
And we're now at the point where watching both these movies, I'm like, oh no, my babies, I love you. I can't part with either of you, but we have to. So where do you want to start?
Let's go ahead and start in one of the interesting comparison points that I noticed. Both Moana and Quasimodo are introduced to us via their interactions with a baby animal.
Right, Moana has the turtle and Quasimodo has the...
some sort of city fowl that would rest inside a gargoyle's mouth.
Something that used to be a velociraptor and now is not.
And both these scenes do a really good job of getting to the core of the character. With Moana, this scene is showing her compassion and care for others, but also showing her interest and the inescapable draw of the sea that she experiences. And that's always the conflict that Moana is under. That's always what she is trying to balance in her life.
You get the sense from looking backward and forward with this film, that was the test for Moana to kind of see what she valued. And she's given the choice between this really shiny rock versus helping an innocent. And it's really cool that the juxtaposition of greed versus care for others is kind of the main test of the thing.
Whereas in Hunchback, you have Quasimodo, who is encouraging this young bird to finally take its first flight.
And specifically talking about how this is a good day for it because the Feast of Fools its day, which is both a cool way to let us know that Quasimodo is super into the Feast of Fools and what it is, organically work into a conversation.
Quasi also uses the phrase,
"Nobody wants to be cooped up here forever,"
which actually comes back a little bit later in the scene where Laverne uses those words against him to convince him to sneak out and go to the Feast of Fools.
Nobody wants to stay cooped up here forever.
It's also interesting because for most of the film, Quasimodo almost physically can't conceive of leaving, where that scene shows that clearly somewhere in there he knows that you're supposed to go.
However, that scene also does kind of make me question why we need the gargoyles in the first place. The gargoyles are one of the...
the worst parts of the movie?
I was trying not to use that harsh of a language, but it's appropriate
the
here.
The least good parts of the movie.
I understand why they're there, otherwise you would have Quasimodo just kind of talking into thin air. This is a technique that is used lots of places to move a character's internal monologue into external dialogue.
We've talked about that before, but here it doesn't work because you have all these characters with their own agendas who have to kind of be their own characters instead of just Quasimodo's shoulder angel or shoulder devil or whatever.
And the thing is, there's so many other things that Quasi could personify in order to have that dynamic. He has the birds that nest up there. He has his own little wood carving miniatures. He has the bells that he actually names, and they all have personalities.
He has all the statues of saints and other religious figures over time.
Or you could have also moved a lot of this to the deacon.
Yeah, yeah. So last time we talked about Hunchback of Notre Dame, Daniel Na, who was on our podcast a while back during the Tarzan vs. Big Hero 6 episode, wrote this beautiful treatise about how the deacon is the real villain of the movie. And I totally agree. The deacon should be doing a lot more to help with this.
Yeah, the deacon's had 20 years to deal with Frollo and has done absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm. I think something that Moana succeeds at where Hunchback doesn't is that whole external internal dialogue stuff where for Moana it's mostly just, hey. She talks to Hey pretty often, and that's a good way to express her feelings about things. You know, Hey and or the ocean. Where the ocean is more of a character, Hey is more of a plot device and / liability. There it's successful because Hey doesn't talk back, he collects.
I went to Julia.
It falls off of the boat a lot.
And before Hey, they have Pua the pig. There's kind of this sort of bait and switch. Everyone kind of assumes that Pua is going to be her animal companion on her journey. That kind of gets into this stealth theme that Moana has of questioning your assumptions and perceptions of the world. It gets reinforced over and over again. Probably the biggest, though, is Maui and Taka. So we've talked about Maui as being the villain, but throughout the film, he's portrayed with all these heroic traits, and they extol the greatness of Maui quite a bit. And
he was a demigod of the wind and sea.
But when they introduce Taka to the narrative, the grandmother who's narrating the legend specifically calls her a
demon of earth and fire.
But what you find out at the end of the film is that Taka is Tafiti after she's been stripped of the heart and she's raw and she constantly hurts because she's exposed to the water kind of without her skin. It's almost like she's been flayed alive.
Eesh, basically.
And the fight between them at the beginning is portrayed as this grand epic thing where Maui good versus Taka evil. However, by the end of the film, you realize that's not the case and that Maui is the person who has done wrong here. And he has to accept that and apologize and work to remedy that situation.
You talked about Maui being an anti-villain, using that, like the square.
So those of you who don't know, Jax and I are actually big fans of Matt Colville. And he recently had a video talking about player characters and playing evil characters specifically. And uses the dichotomy of the hero and villain, but also the dichotomy of the anti-hero and anti-villain. And that conception of roles in a story helped me kind of solidify how Maui fits into this film. He's distinctly an anti-villain. He is a villain who is doing bad things for what he perceives as the right reason. And he is shown to have all these heroic characteristics. And much of the arc of the film is Moana trying to get Maui to understand the harm that he's caused and get him to help her fix that wrong. And it's a redemption arc.
A quick jump off of that, because Maui has to straddle the hero-villain line a lot, they had to kind of play with the visual experience of Maui, making him look more sinister or more jovial at different times. Mm-hmm. And because they put so much work into the hair for these characters and let the hair be big and wild, they have a lot of scenes where Maui's hair will cast just enough of a shadow on his face to look, make him look a little more sinister than he might otherwise. And it's a really good, subtle way to do that. Specifically in the scene where he talks about how...
Yes, because it only appears after a human sacrifice.
And the light is just behind him enough that the hair casts this dark shadow. He's like, oh no, is it real? Just for a second, you believe it.
Although, now that I've watched this movie about 4 times this year, the subtle clues that they give you to figure out that, no, Maui's the bad guy of this film are just becoming more and more apparent. I question how anyone who's really paying attention can watch the opening sequence with Maui and Taka and not get that. It's very obvious via the lighting and Maui's facial expressions and how everything's framed.
I think part of it is that Maui is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. That's partially facetious that, you know, we inherently trust Dwayne The Rock Johnson to be there for us in our time of need. But also, the sort of character that he's playing is a stereotypical jock that you see in a lot of films where we accept that they're popular because they're popular. Despite him, you know, being on an island, he still has that bravado.
Whereas in Hunchback, I don't think it's ever more clear in Disney film who the villain is and why they are bad.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Maleficent.
But to be fair to Maleficent, she was wronged. She was not invited to the party.
True.
She overreacted to not getting an invitation, but there was a legitimate grievance.
Whereas Frollo's introduced chasing a woman down on horseback.
There's actually some weirdness of that scene, though. So the Romani man in the boat, when they're kind of the jig is up moment, he exclaims,
Judge Claude Frollo!
As opposed to just Frollo, it seems really weird and not natural.
That thing where they're trying to introduce a character, but it comes off more like, ah, hello, James, my brother of 17 years.
There's also some weird lighting in that scene, mostly due to all of it taking place when it's completely overcast and snowing, but everything's drawn like there's this direct light source. I don't know, everything just seems kind of out of place during that flashback scene.
Which stands out in a film that has a lot of good lighting stuff.
Exactly. That's the only reason that I'm picking on it here.
There are 2 things I really like about that scene. Partially, the writing for that song is spectacular. The way the rhymes are very atypical is really cool. Like the bit where it's like,
at a figure whose clutches were iron as much as the bells of Notre Dame.
A really good line. Also, a cool thing, in that scene, twice the city is against Frollo. He hits his head on a sign when he's riding past, and then he can't fit through a narrow gap that Quasimodo's mom can fit through. And then at the end of the film, the people of the city rise up against him, but also Notre Dame itself falls apart on him and lets him fall to his death. It's kind of this cool way of making the city of Paris this character who is actively acting against him.
Because of how they use the Deacon, I really wish that the Deacon was not a physical character, but just a manifestation of Frollo's conscience.
Right.
However, because the Deacon specifically interacts with Esmeralda and the soldiers during the sanctuary scene, that's definitely not that.
Also, they couldn't really get away with making Frollo a priest in this movie. I get it. I mean, they go as far as they possibly can, but...
Well, throughout the film, it's very clear that Frollo sees himself as, if not God, a direct vessel for his will.
Mm-hmm. There's even a bit where Clopin, he's listing off people in the city, including priests, and he has Frollo costume on or a Frollo doll when he's saying that. So it's very clear that everybody wants you to know that Frollo is functionally a priest in this narrative.
Mm-hmm.
As a quick sidebar for that, I really like that the cross in his room where he has the Hellfire scene looks like a sword. It's a really cool thing.
And that kind of comes back to where he's wielding the sword against Esmeralda right before he falls. And he's specifically quoting the Bible as...
And he shall smite the wicked and plunge them into the fiery pit.
This is what I am about to do to you because I am God.
Yeah. God, Frollo's messy and scary.
Yeah.
And he's a really interesting character. Even the subtle things. Again, back to... Thank you, Daniel, for pointing this out. There's a bit where Frollo is talking about how...
Out there they'll revile you as a monster.
Quasimodo responds with, I am a monster. Taking what Frollo has said and doubling down on it. And it's interesting that you can see how Frollo is probably acting in ways that he thinks are not unjustified. He doesn't think of himself as a monster for most of the narrative, which most monsters don't.
Although... That song in general has some significant mood whiplash. So it's very somber and like know your place, Quasimodo, when Frollo is singing it. But as soon as he leaves and Quasi takes over, the tone of the song completely shifts. It's, I don't know, it's kind of weird.
It's not the biggest mood whiplash in this movie. We've talked about that before.
No. Unfortunately, them trying to fit so much music in... While a lot of it's great, and a lot of it is incredibly thematic and plays off of the narrative well, some of it is very badly placed, and it throws off the emotions that you should be feeling.
I have a hard time picking what movie has better music. I think they're both really good, and what sticks out to me with Hunchback is that it all feels very cohesive, whereas Moana has a lot of different kinds of music that don't all fit together.
I would say the exact opposite, actually. Really? I think while... Moana has all these various different styles of music in it. The first portion of the film has three very different songs. Where You Are, How Far I'll Go, and We Know the Way. One of them is sung mostly by the village, specifically Moana's father, and Moana kind of sings it. One is solely Moana's song, and then We Know the Way is this sort of flashback sequence to the past of Moana's people. And then they use elements of all three of those songs later at the climax of the film, right when Moana is about to give up and the spirit of her grandmother comes and starts it, and they grab elements of all of those to construct the song I Am Moana.
Mm-hmm. And then the same kind of song comes back during the short song during the healing of Te Fiti. And then the other songs are just sung by people who are outside of that world. So I take it back. It is all very cohesive with additions. Ignore me.
I think Moana uses its music much better than Hunchback does.
Mm.
I don't think either of them have bad music. I just think that the music in Hunchback does not always serve the narrative, where I think the music always serves the narrative in Moana.
That's true. I want to talk about another thing that serves the narrative in Moana that's really interesting to me.
Okay.
So in episode 4 of Blue Flame Special, Patrick H. Williams talks about the direction of action in Terminator 2. And how, even though you have a very chaotic action scene when the T-1000 is chasing everybody else out of the prison, the camera is always essentially on the same plane. The protagonists are always fleeing to the right, whereas the T-1000 is always chasing from the left. And when the protagonists turn around to attack him, even when he's not on screen, they're still facing that direction. And then eventually, like, the truck there and turns around, and then it changes, and then it stays consistent throughout. Moana has kind of the same thing. You have three spaces, where the camera is, then to the left, which is like the return to the center. That pile of rocks basically is kind of the very center of things. And then to the right is always beyond. Whenever Moana is escaping to go off to sea or to jump on a boat or to go to Te Fiti's island, it's always to the right, always motion to the right. Whereas whenever she's trying to go back, it's always motion to the left. And even in subtle ways, like when Maui is trapping her in the cave, he sends her off to the left. And she has to get out through above, but still to the right. Or when Moana's grandmother and ancestors come to her, they come from the left. So from home, from the center, and then they move her towards the right. So they're moving her towards the beyond. And it's a really cool thing that there's always the same construction of motion that creates this like subtle thematic resonance to stuff.
Yeah. When Moana is moving to the right, she is always progressing the plot. When she is moving to the left, she is always regressing, with one exception, and that is when she is returning the Heart of Te Fiti.
And even that, as I think, it's still a return. It's a regression, but it's a regression that's needed. It's a going back to what was.
Well, I would also argue that it's not necessarily a regression. It's still moving the plot forward. It's just that the character that we're supposed to be focusing on is Taka/Te Fiti as opposed to Moana.
That makes sense to me, yeah. And by the same token, when Nally's hook is broken and he decides he doesn't want to do the quest anymore and he flies off, he's also flying back away instead of progressing forward.
As soon as you notice that little thing, everything just kind of clicks together, and it's really interesting watching how just the motion the characters are moving in affects the tone of a scene.
Mm-hmm. And it leads to some interesting spiritual things, like the regression is, you know, it's going back, but it's not always a bad thing. Sometimes it means that, like, returning to ancestral wisdom or a safe space or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of ancestral wisdom, I really like how Grandma never chastises Moana for her choices, or even tries to convince her to change her mind. She supports Moana no matter what her decision is to move forward or not. And the ocean at the very end of the film, when Moana asks,
"Choose someone else, please,"
also respects those wishes. It's really nice.
I was focusing a lot on Grandma this time, too. So in Women Who Run With the Wolves, Clarissa Estes talks about the necessity of the wild woman as an archetype in stories, someone who kind of carries unique wisdom, and I think Grandma is a case of that. She's aberrant from the norm. Specifically, she's a woman who lives at the edge of time, or the woman who lives at the edge of the world, both friend and mother to all those who have lost their way, those who need learning, and those who have a riddle to solve, those out in the forest or the desert, wandering and searching. She doesn't seek Moana out. She just stands there and offers this alternative and waits for Moana to come to her. And even when Moana is unsure, she doesn't press things upon her. Like, there's that bit where Moana says,
"Is there something you want to tell me?"
And Grandma says,
"Is there something you want to hear?"
Which is a great line. One more thing about Grandma, and this is kind of a sad point, because of how they Disney-fied Maui as a character of significance in legend and myth, to put it broadly, I'm kind of sad that they took away the grandma's jawbone aspect of his story, because his fishhook is his grandma's jawbone that she gave willingly, which, that's a cool thing. Would have been cool if it still was in the movie, because then they could have bonded over gifts from grandmas. That could have been a cool, weird bonding thing. I get that explaining how this hook is a jawbone would be tricky, but they could have made it into a comedy thing as well, and I'm kind of sad that they miss out on an opportunity to both do justice to history and legend and also to have a cool story moment.
I also understand Disney's hesitance to start talking about human bones and skeletons and whatnot as a significant part of their narrative.
Sure.
That seems very off-brand for Disney.
You say that, but then there's, like, people just walking through whole catacombs full of skulls in Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, but they don't mention it.
That's true.
Another thing I really like about Grandma is the authenticity of her age.
Mm.
Very often in Disney films, a aged character, especially an aged woman character, they don't really do a lot to show her age. They'll give her white or gray or graying hair, and that's really about it.
She's either, like, just a person with white hair, or she's, like, a Yoda, like with Mulan's grandmother, where she's sort of, like, goblin-esque figure.
Mm-hmm. Whereas with Grandma, she's not completely shrunken down, and she's allowed to have all these wrinkles. She's allowed to have this hairline that's receding and thinning a little bit, but at no point do they make her ugly looking. That's not what they're attempting to do. They're just showing age for what it is.
Mm-hmm. And she's a fat character, but she's still presented as being incredibly beautiful. Like, she's always framed by these very soft sunset lights. She's always moving gracefully with the water. And her fatness allows them to have this a very wide stingray tattoo on the back, which is really cool. Showing more skin than an older fat woman is supposed to in media, but it isn't presented as, like, the horror. The way it is with Ursula, basically.
Looking at Hunchback, the characters that would kind of be that analog is Laverne, and Laverne kind of falls into, like, all of those tropes.
Mm-hmm. There are a few older Romani, but all the Romani are kind of presented as being, like, that specific kind of ugliness that you get from being poor in a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since we're there, I kind of want to dig into the Romani a little bit. I specifically want to talk about the portrayal of the Romani in the film. Throughout most of it, they're portrayed as the paragons of acceptance. Esmeralda with Quasi in her dressing room, making sure that he's okay, making sure that he's comfortable when he kind of just fell in on her changing. Then we also have Clopin calming the crowd during the crowning of the King of Fools.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't panic! We asked for the ugliest face in Paris, and here he is!
And the violence doesn't break out until one of the guards start throwing food. Then Esmeralda stops said violence and frees Quasi. Although, I am going to point out, loses a couple points on the landing for calling Quasi a creature.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that the Romani refuse to give up Esmeralda, even as Frollo is offering them quite a bit of money at the time.
And their freedom.
Yeah. And there's also Esmeralda rescuing Phoebus, who is almost literally dead in the water. So all throughout the film, particularly Esmeralda, but the Romani in general are shown as this very accepting group. They are not going to turn someone away because of how they look or their circumstances. Except the Court of Miracles scene. And I think that really nails why that scene just doesn't work, because they've built up the Romani to have this specific reputation within this world, and then they completely break it as soon as Quasi and Phoebus are captured. They even comment on it.
These men aren't spies, they're our friends.
Why didn't they say so?
We did say so.
I feel like the Court of Miracles seemed like someone was really attached to that idea, and the obvious edits there didn't get made for whatever reason. They were really like into this sham trial scene.
Yeah, someone decided that they were unwilling to kill their darlings.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, the Court of Miracles scene is fairly close to the book. I mean, as much as you can for a Disney movie, you can't show some of the things from the book in a Disney movie ever. But I get where they're going for, but it just doesn't fit with what things became.
And like barring the Court of Miracles scene, it's also really interesting how the Romani play into the overall narrative of the story, besides Esmeralda, who is a protagonist. Frollo comments that there's a war for the heart Paris when he is first talking with Phoebus. And the thing is, he's right. Every time that we're dealing with a crowd of Parisians, they change who they're rooting for on a complete whim. If Clopin or Esmeralda are saying, you should do this, then they're all for that. But as soon as the guards start throwing fruit, then they're like, yeah, let's humiliate and torture this, you know, disfigured man.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always this back and forth pull of who is winning the heart of the Parisians. Our protagonists and the Romani and the diverse Paris, or Frollo's incredibly authoritarian, pious, and homogenous version of Paris.
Using the crowd to show both who's winning an argument and also this push and pull of these two social norms is a cool idea. I do wish it was more subtle than them just flipping back and forth like a light switch. Although I do appreciate that at the end, the crowd falls on the side of justice and doing the right thing and rebelling against the tyrants and guillotines. That's a cool scene.
There's some weirdness getting there when Quasi saves Esmeralda from execution and climbs the church and starts shouting,
"Sanctuary!"
He's kind of like pumping her up and down like a prop, and it's kind of this weird objectification of Esmeralda.
Yeah, while we're there, there's some really awkward color symbolism in this movie. So there's a lot of green and purple, which is sort of the traditional Disney colors of the villains. And it's interesting that both Esmeralda and Frollo have green and purple as a significant color motif. And then Frollo moves from the purple robes and the green ring to the black and red that's the same color as the police. So it's kind of this movement from moral ambiguity to state violence. And then Esmeralda moves from green and purple to just white and kind of purity, innocence, goodness, and all that jazz, which I get what they're going for. It's kind of heavy-handed.
There's also some other weirdness. So Phoebus is also moved to white after his injury. And then after the climax, after Frollo's defeated, both of them come out of the church next together and the crowd's all cheering. And it feels very much like a wedding.
Yeah.
Which is weird. I know that they get married in the book. That's how Esmeralda saves him from being murdered by the other Romani.
As you do.
But I don't know. It just felt kind of weird. There's also the fact that green and purple are also very much the colors of Mardi Gras, and that kind of feeds into the whole Feast of Fools thing.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that Disney probably should have changed up their color symbolism for this film. their normal fare works here.
Yeah, they're definitely trying for a thing, but I think there is kind of too much happening that doesn't get worked through all the way. One thing I do think that works really well about the ending, though. So in the book, Quasimodo dies. Like, that's a sad thing. And this is one of the first movies that really explores how much of a victim Quasimodo is through the general archetype of the story, but the story in particular. And I like that the tension of the climax doesn't end when Frollo falls into the fiery pit of Paris. It ends when Quasimodo doesn't die. And I like that it's the sort of subliminal message that it's not enough to kill a villain, you also have to save the victim.
And they really hammer home just how much of a victim Quasimodo is. They really get into how Frollo is abusing and grooming him. There's a lot of lines about Frollo specifically.
Even this foul creature may yet prove one day to be of use to me.
And you know, Quasi that should be faithful to Frollo. And the way they portray the emotional abuse is relatively accurate, and that can be difficult to watch for those in the know.
Yeah. A thing I was focused on to a perhaps excessive degree this time through, when Frollo comes to Quasimodo and starts his daily lesson with the alphabet, it's weird that they're just doing the alphabet. Quasimodo looks like he's between 16 and 20. Like, you'd think they'd be beyond that by now. And that made me wonder, okay, well, what's education like in this time period? And it's a rabbit hole, because education is changing a lot at the time, because it's going from being just kids are taught to read the Bible and then a trade to having actual colleges and learning natural philosophy and stuff. And so I was wondering if this is an inaccurate portrayal of the time, narrative shorthand just to show that he's learning a lesson, or is it a further exploration of how Frollo and to a greater or lesser extent the deacon are failing Quasimodo, because education was based around the church at the time, so Quasimodo's right there. He lives in the school. Why isn't he being taught things beyond A is for abomination, B is for bashful, F is for failure?
I mean, I very much read the lowered expectations for Quasi's education as more having to do with his physical deformity and people underestimating his intelligence because of it.
I can see that.
While we're talking about Frollo, one really interesting thing I noticed is that Quasimodo's speech patterns change when Frollo's in the room. He develops a significant stutter, and he has these long pauses where he's kind of tentative, like, I don't want to say the wrong thing and get punished. Which, all of that lines up with the abuse that Frollo puts him through. That's all kind of textbook. However, what's really interesting is the way that Phoebus also stutters during his first introductions to Frollo during their conversation about what Frollo has hired Phoebus to do, so to speak. And I thought that was a really interesting way to, before these characters even meet, start planting the seeds that they are going to be both working against Frollo.
And that resonates pretty well with me, because I also have some mild speech troubles, and it for a while was worse when I was talking about things I was excited about, because there is a certain aspect of like getting too excited and not planning my words through. And so when someone pointed that out to me, I was like, oh, interesting. And then it let me understand myself better. So good job, Disney. You found a very real thing. Initially, I thought that I didn't really care about Quasimodo as a character, but I was more into Esmeralda. I think it's more that I don't care about the Quasimodo-Esmeralda romance. I don't think it works at all. And because chunks of the film are devoted to that instead of any other thing, it makes me less excited about Quasimodo, because the romance is a little bit one-sided, whereas I like all the stuff that Esmeralda is doing.
The romance, I don't think it needs to be there, and the places where it's at can be very easily cut or easily changed to ignore it. I mean, for the most part, Quasi doesn't even realize that romance is an option, and just like, no, she's just a friend. If it weren't for the goddamn gargoyles, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Man, if I had a nickel. Whereas on the flip side with Moana, I'm glad they didn't try to do a romance arc with Moana and Maui. That would have been weird.
That would have been uncomfortable on a lot of levels.
Yeah. I have seen some commentary that Moana as a protagonist of color being denied a romance is different than a white protagonist not having a romance, because it interacts with themes of women of color being not desirable as romantic options. That is definitely a problem, but I think it's more of a problem with the way that Moana is being talked about than Moana itself. Because I don't think Moana necessarily needs a romantic option for the narrative, but on a meta level, I get where that problem comes in.
Also, there's not really a good candidate for that. Maui is obviously not a good candidate. And after she leaves the island, there's no more humans in the narrative. There's these three cute fishing guys that are there, but then Moana starts talking about fishing beyond the reef, and her dad starts yelling at her about it, and then you see all three of those guys kind of look away and sigh, and I very much read that it's like, you know, if it weren't for her dad, I'd ask her out.
That said, I've read Moby Dick. Nothing good comes from cute fishing guys.
While we're on Moana, this is the fourth time I've watched it this year, and there's always more that I'm just finding and dissecting. And it Moana's main theme is very obviously figuring out yourself and where you belong and all that sort of self-discovery stuff. But there's so much else going on that is not typical in a Disney film. There's Maui's redemption arc. There's the questioning assumptions and perceptions. There's the reconnecting with your ancestors aspect. There's so many ways to look at what's going on in Moana, and I find that really interesting.
And beyond themes, also the way the film is structured, like the very dreamlike quality of it, the way the characters will kind of come in and out of visions or out of memories and into and out of different animation styles very fluidly. They kind of feed into this psychedelic in a very literal way of being like deluged into the psyche, the left to right thing. The way the plot structure is very odd, doesn't have clearly defined first, second, third act the way a lot of films do.
It's getting to be about that time. I think I know where my vote's headed, but I also wouldn't mind throwing out a few last minute neat things to finish this off.
Sure.
So one little thing that I liked in Moana is there's this conversation that is sort of happening off screen because the camera is focused on Moana, but the chief is saying,
"Mother, Motu Nui is paradise. Who would want to go anywhere else?"
And the thought I had just, you're tempting fate awfully hard there, chief.
I think I love about Moana is how the heart of Tefiti doesn't really do anything. It maybe keeps Grandma healthy, but beyond that, it's just a MacGuffin. And I think it's a really cool thing that they didn't try to like make it more magical than just its function of the story.
So the voice actor who plays Quasimodo was Pinto in Animal House, but he also played Mozart in Amadeus, the movie. In the 80s. And during the worst song in the film, the gargoyles convincing Quasimodo, like, yes, you should pursue Esmeralda romantically, they do the whole, oh, we're going to cut your hair makeover thing. And they, you know, spin around real fast. He comes out with this powdered wig that looks exactly like the wig that the actor wore in Amadeus.
I feel like Amadeus is not super well remembered, even with Amadeus 2 being something you can listen to at theequalizers.podbean.com. But I feel like Disney kind of gambled on that being something people remembered and it didn't pay off for them, because I didn't notice that any time apart from you saying it just now.
I don't think it's a very overt reference, but I don't think missing that reference hurts the film's watchability at all.
Yeah, that's fair. I have a few more things for Hunchback, but since we only have space for one, I'm just going to have you put in that one clip of Frollo saying,
"Silence!"
and Esmeralda saying,
"Justice!"
That's all. That's my final point.
Solid point.
Enough said.
And with that, I think we're ready to cast our first vote for the quarterfinals.
Woo!
What's moving forward?
Moana.
Same. Hunchback's had a really good run. Going into this bracket, it was one of my least favorite Disney films. I've come to appreciate it quite a bit more, but I think Moana's music is much better incorporated into its narrative, and it just has quite a bit more going on. I think if Hunchback got another shot, whether via, you know, a complete reworking, or I honestly don't think it would work well in a live-action adaptation, but I think there's quite a bit of good there in Hunchback.
Christopher Lee is dead, so no one can play Claude Frollo anymore.
Christopher Lee didn't play Claude Frollo.
Exactly, and it's a tragedy. He would be the only person I want to see playing live-action Claude Frollo. Hunchback is really good, and I'm sad to see it go, but there's just, you know, little bits here and there that aren't quite as strong. That said, the experience of some of the songs and how well they work with the visuals is truly staggering, and all the animators there should be very proud of their work.
Yeah. If nothing else, this film gave us the amazing sequence of Heaven's Light into the transition of Hellfire. And if you take away nothing else from that film, just those two sequences are amazing.
Mm-hmm. So with that, Moana moves forward and Hunchback of Notre Dame is cast into the fiery pit. What's up next week?
Next week, we have Beauty and the Beast versus Dinosaur.
How did we get there?
Well, I think we're going to have a very long, interesting discussion about that next episode. If you want to make sure to catch that, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and right here at Podbean. We only have about half a dozen episodes left of this bracket, so if you are a binge listener, now is probably a good time to hop in.
Also, I keep forgetting to plug the other podcast that I started with my friend Mike Knoll. We are watching the 1980s Granada television series adaptation of Sherlock Holmes and doing a read-along. So if you want to jump in, we're only about three episodes in at this point. The episodes and stories are easy to find online.
Also, earlier this episode, you heard us name drop The Equalizers, as well as Daniel Na, who hosts the OK Crusader podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You should check both of those out as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that does it for us this week. Thank you all very much for listening, and we hope you tune in next time.